911, what's your emergency?
Karma's a bitch. I should have known better. I thought about having you answer, like, is this an emergency, ma'am? And then just having me be like, no.
But no, that's honestly, I think, like, if we leave it with, like, the JoJo Siwa musical sting, that will be, like, fun. Or, well, with your singing, of course, because we don't want to get copyright struck by her legal team.
Of course.
Could you imagine if, like, we had an episode get demonetized because
we sang a JoJo Siwa song?
And she was like, cease and desist. This is not my artistic intent.
I could see her being kind of defensive about that. Did you see that tweet recently that was like, JoJo Siwa was performing at somebody's college?
What?
Yeah, no? she was like giving a talk, it looked like. But then they said she did like an impromptu performance of her Karma's a Bitch song.
Oh.
It was weird.
So I'm not up on, I guess, the discourse around her, other than the gay memes that have gone around gay Twitter.
I think the discourse is just that people find her embarrassing and bad at music.
Which is probably fair.
I don't know if there's much more than that.
Which is probably fair. I mean, you know, I've never gone out of my way to listen to her songs, but I did watch that music video, and I thought the song was bad. It does seem like, even when she just posts a video of her dance, like, do you remember, like, the elephant trunk dance? Like, that TikTok?
I do not.
It seems like sometimes she'll just post and people pounce.
Yeah, I think she's sort of that type of internet figure. All of this to say that today's episode, season one, episode 8, is titled Karma's a Bitch.
Yes.
It's funny, we were just saying like how many pop songs there are recently about karma. There's Karma by Taylor Swift. There's My Kink is Karma by Chapel Roan. And of course, most famously, there's Karma's a Bitch by JoJo Siwa.
Yeah, it seems like the pop girlies are like really like starting to reckon with this dark facet of society.
Yeah, they're really into karma. I also wanted to say this episode features a couple different karma-themed songs, which was pretty funny. I've said before, I love this show's on-the-nose music choices.
It had two of my favorite needle drops.
Yeah, they use Karma Chameleon. Favorites. They use Instant Karma.
And then, like, You Oughta Know.
They use You Oughta Know,
which is so fun. I heard that come on, and I was just like, oh, shit, we're getting some real shit.
For real. Well, so I have to say, you know how I sometimes research who wrote these episodes? This episode, first episode of the show written by Kristen Rydell.
Really?
And it's kind of a banger, right?
It is a banger. Honestly, I was watching this episode and I was like, wait, I'm really loving this episode. This one is so good.
This episode was, I think, the first one I realized while watching it, the first one in season one that is really feeling like classic 911 to me, you know, like true 911 vibes. And I hate to say it, but I realized it might be because Abby's not in this episode.
Oh, yeah, that's so true. We only get a couple of like glimpses of her when she's answering 911 calls.
So I think that's maybe why it just feels a little more like the show feels later on. But obviously, we love Abby.
Yeah, well, we got a lot of Chimney in this scene, too. We got a lot of, in this episode, we got a lot of Chimney, especially him and Bobby.
Yeah, oh, I love the Chimney and Bobby stuff in this episode.
It's so good.
I wrote in my notes, Chobby.
Chobby. Okay, I was thinking, when he was, like, there in the, we'll get to it, but, like, when he was there in the hospital, I was like, okay, so Jane says that earlier they were setting up Bobby and Abby. Now they're setting up Bobby and Chimney.
You just don't understand what I was getting at in that episode. And I want to take a moment to thank all of the commenters who supported me in my assertion that that episode felt like it was setting up Bobby and Abby, because I knew I wasn't crazy and I will not allow myself to be gaslit anymore.
I want to take a moment to apologize to our viewers.
Thank you.
Because, and to you, Jane, specifically.
Thank you.
Because I didn't realize just how wrong I could be. And though I know in my heart I'm right, you all seem to disagree. And I'm humble enough to own up to that.
Okay, that was a great apology. Why don't we get into the episode?
So we open on a 911 call. We did a couple of cold opens the last few episodes, so this time we're going back into opening on a call.
And right on the moment he calls 911.
Yeah, and he says, I've been shot. And we see a man lying. He's bleeding from his chest. And next to him is a rifle. And so you think, did he shoot himself? What's going on? And then the 118 rolls up and they say, oh, you know, we've been here before, right? Buck's like, I haven't. And it turns out to be a flashback to a year ago from before Buck joined the 118. They got a call.
I thought it was interesting that this means that Buck has been with the 118 for less than a year in season one.
Less than a year. Yeah. He was pretty fresh, but you also got the sense that he was like established in the first episode. Yeah. You know what I mean?
I guess it could have been like a few months, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. They went to a Springsteen concert together.
Exactly. Like how they would have needed to establish a little bit of closeness before doing that.
I gotta say, somehow we haven't mentioned that until now, but in the first episode, Bobby mentions that he and Buck went to a Springsteen concert together.
Did we really not mention that in our first episode?
We didn't
at
mention
all?
It. I talk about that all the time. Multiple times. No, yeah. I mean, like, I know you're a big Boss fan. You know, I like Springsteen.
I am.
And, like, we, like, haven't even fucking mentioned that.
What do you think their favorite albums are? Because I think Buck is totally a Born in the USA fan. Like the album,
not just
the song. I just think that vibe of that whole album, like you know, No Surrender is a very Buck song. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Darlington County is a very Buck song. Even the more angsty stuff like I'm on Fire, Cover Me, whatever, those all feel very Buck. Bobby, I'm not so sure about. I feel like maybe he would be into like one of the more recent albums, like maybe he'd be like a Western Stars fan.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Tell me more. Because honestly, I was thinking Bobby would be really into Born in the USA.
I think Born in the USA.
No Surrender in particular.
Too...
I can picture him like listening to that with his earbuds on and just like crying and just being like,
Maybe later on, I feel like Born in the USA as an album has like a few too many like exuberant moments for Bobby. I feel like he'd be into something more angsty, like maybe like Darkness on the Edge of Town.
Mm-hmm. That's fair. That's fair.
Although I feel like Darkness on the Edge of Town is kind of an Eddie album also.
Okay, but maybe Bobby was having like an Eddie moment like in his living room, in his underwear, like dancing to like you know.
But also Tunnel of Love is also in an Eddie album. Although the song Tougher Than the Rest is totally a Buck song. I don't even want to admit how much thinking I've already put into this.
Okay, Jane, you do realize that you just made a buddy connection. Again.
I did. And you know what? I'm not sorry for it either. But you know what else?
A buddy Springsteen. What's up?
You know what else? The song The River is like literally story of Eddie's life. So there's that too.
So when I say I'm a Springsteen fan, I'm a very casual fan.
I
listened to his songs, you know, growing up on the radio and everything. I only know the one album by him. But I know a lot of like his like random songs and stuff like that. But you're throwing out a lot of names right now, and so I'm just like nodding my head. I'm going along with it because I've learned that in this instance, like when I'm disagreeing with you, I should just like hold my tongue and support you because our viewers will take your side.
Ooh, wow! I'm the favorite. Oh my god. No, I will say. I mean, The River is just like this sad ass song about a guy who gets his girlfriend pregnant in high school and has to like give up on his dreams and marry her, and they are sad all the time. So that feels like Eddie to me.
It's like an inverse of Fast Car by Tracy Chapman.
Yeah. I'll just like make you a playlist or something that's like Bruce Springsteen as 911 characters, and I'll have
make a thread on Twitter.
Yeah, oh my god, that would be so like nerdy of me, but anyway, we should move on back to
911 characters
at hand.
I can't but we're with the 118 and we're getting it back on track. We're doing it.
Yeah, we flash back to a year ago. And they had responded to a call at this same house of the wife of this guy who got shot had hanged herself. And, you know, the guy's standing and she's dead on arrival, basically. And the guy's like, why would she do this? And Hen and Bobby immediately notice she's got like scars, bruises on her wrists, whatever. Like, clearly this is a battered woman. And so they're kind of, you know, they're kind of sassing him, which is like, I would say appropriate in this situation. And we see kind of a flashback within the flashback.
Yeah. I mean, he's not upset at all, by the way.
Yeah. We get a flashback within the flashback where he is, you know, pushing his wife around, and she mm-hmm. pulls a gun on him, and she's like, I'll kill you if you touch me again, whatever.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. he kind of wrestles the gun from her, and it goes off and hits the tree.
Yeah. Yeah. So, like, she, like, the crux of, I guess, this, like, this argument is that, like, she's trying to leave mm-hmm. because, you know, he's abusing her, and she found a guy on the side, so she claims, and then he, you know, like, threatens her. She pulls a gun. And he sort of goads her into firing at him because he goes to like charge at her. She fires, misses, hits the tree, and then he wrestles it out of her hands, mm-hmm. hits her, and
he says this horrible thing to her where he's like, the only way you'll get out of this relationship basically is if you use that gun to shoot yourself. And so yeah. mm-hmm. it's basically, I mean,
he basically taunts her into killing herself.
Yeah, he basically provoked her to do this. And then a year later in the present, the tree has become diseased, presumably because of this yeah. one bullet kind of poisoning it. And that mm-hmm. in itself, I thought was so like poetic and cool. Like, I liked
yeah.
that.
He seems to have an affection for this tree.
Yeah, weirdly enough.
Yeah, he says like, yeah, the tree is still standing, but she isn't, or something like that. It's like
when
really
you love
up.
Your tree more than you love your wife.
just God forbid men have hobbies. No. Cut that out.
Men will literally explode a tree and get shot in the process rather than go to therapy.
Literally.
But he hears like an estimate from the yeah. tree guy. What are the tree cutter guy? Whatever the tree, that job yeah. is called.
I think it's landscaping.
Yeah, whatever. And he's like, no, I don't want an estimate. I'm going to do this myself. He picks mm-hmm. probably the stupidest method ever
it's
to
so
fell
fucking
this
stupid.
Tree. He tapes yeah. a bunch of explosives around it and then decides to shoot it with a rifle to like set off the explosives.
Can I ask where he got the explosives? Like they're like in little bags and like... What are they? Is it just like packed with like kerosene and gunpowder? Like,
or you know, like C4 or something. I don't know.
Military surplus stores.
I don't know where you go to buy big packs of explosives.
Mm-hmm. But he takes like a little hunting rifle.
Yeah, shoots it to like again. Maybe this is like an established way of felling a tree that we're not aware of. But is this? I've never heard of just exploding a tree to remove it from your property.
So my dad does a lot of landscaping on, you know, his property and everything. And I gotta say, in my 24 years of knowing the man, I've never once heard even a whisper of explosives to do so.
Well, maybe he doesn't know how they do it down in L.A.
Right. he's not Hollywood enough for this.
No.
He has to stick with his chainsaw and wood chipper.
Mm-hmm.
If anything, maybe it's like a character thing that he's this like macho and like.
I think so. I think it's supposed to be like, oh, what a brute! He's exploding yeah. mm-hmm. the tree. But anyway, by mm-hmm. doing this, he dislodges this bullet, which goes flying out directly into his chest. And, you know, karma's a bitch.
Yeah.
And that's
yeah.
how we got where we are now. And I think yeah. it's implied that he dies. We kind of cut away as he's drifting in and out. And so
yeah.
I'm not sure what the result was. But hopefully he died.
Yeah. I mean, like, in fairness, something more important happened because Hen says karma's a bitch. We get the title card. And then instantly a karma chameleon needle drop.
It's kind of the most iconic transition
ever.
It's pretty good. Like that, the tone of this call is very, very like bleak and somber. Mm-hmm. And then it's just like, karma chameleon. We cut to the station is doing a blood drive. So everybody's giving blood. We've got like Hens giving blood, Bucks giving blood. Chimney is running the whole operation. And he's like, mm-hmm. wow, we've gotten such good turnout this year. Except Bobby, I'm still missing 2 pints from you. You haven't
yeah.
given blood yet. What's up with that? And everybody starts kind of taunting him for it. And he reveals that he hates needles. So he mm-hmm. never gets blood drawn.
We get a legit cutaway gag.
Yeah,
Bobby,
first of the show, I think.
We get a legit cutaway gag like of him like in a hospital, like it just like it, like getting like his physical or whatever, and the mm-hmm. doctor goes to like take his blood and he just passes the fuck out,
falls right out of the chair. Yeah.
And you know, then Chim's basically like, I want to say guilting Bobby into helping. And
I mean,
Hen
he has
and
like
Buck
good reason to guilt him, but that is what he's doing.
Yeah, and then Hen and Buck come up and give Bobby the puppy eyes, and it's just such a scene of like, this man can't say no to his children.
His children.
Under any circumstance.
Well, specifically, Chimney is like, listen, when I got that rebar through my skull a few episodes ago, I got, what, like 10 units of blood, and it was all from these kind people who donated blood, so I want to repay the favor. So they get Bobby to agree to it, and then we cut to Athena and Michael.
Yeah. I just want to say, before we get into the Michael scene, I just want to ask, like, just a very honest, open question. Who gave Chim the clipboard? Because we talk a lot about clipboard Buck.
But clipboard Chimney.
But we don't talk enough about clipboard Chimney.
He seems like a menace in his own right.
He is. He's a different kind of menace. He's smiley, he's charismatic, and he's emotionally manipulative.
I was going to say, he can manipulate you into doing whatever he wants. Mm-hmm.
Just give that man a clipboard and he can do anything.
The clipboard, and maybe the clipboards in the 911 universe have some sort of special power that sort of make the wielder give them certain powers.
If anything, it just proves that maybe it's a commentary on authority. Maybe it's like, you know, Bobby has authority. Hen is second in command. She gets authority when he's unable to, you know, whatever. And it's like, man, just it's like a glimpse into what would happen if Buck or Chim were in like the captain's seat.
Yeah. But then Athena and Michael, I remember now, they have a big argument.
Well, there's like a moment where they're like watching the kids go, and then the minute they're out of eyeshot, Athena sort of shrugs off like Michael's sort of like arm on her shoulders and goes inside, and it's like there's a coldness about them. And it's clear that they're still having a lot of problems.
They have a tense scene where Michael is trying to broach this topic of like, I'd like to introduce my boyfriend Glenn to the kids. And Athena is very not into this idea. Michael, I think they both make some mistakes here. I think we have seen Michael, I think, move too fast before, as Athena is accusing him of here. I also think at this point Athena is being a little too resistant to like anything. And I mean, obviously the major problem, and this will be addressed in this whole episode, is that they have agreed to stay together, like under the same roof, which is obviously not the solution. But she's saying, you know, it's too soon to introduce the kids to Glenn, and he's saying, you know, we've been dating for months, he's a good guy, and they're just not seeing eye to eye.
And there's a real like emotional turmoil with Athena here, because like it's really interesting that, you know, she's shouldering a lot of the emotional burden of this relationship. She's really suffering, and she has been for months, and she's really resenting Michael that he gets to kind of come and go as he pleases, like living under her roof, but also seeing this guy and having this like this blossoming romance. And, you know, she feels like he's moving like right past her, you know what I mean? And he's not seeing her own turmoil, and he's definitely not matching it. I think, you know, he is not suffering in the way that she's suffering, you know what I mean?
No,
you know, she's suffering like day in and day out, you know, living with this constant reminder of, you know, this thing that happened that was completely out of her control. And, you know, it's painful. It's really, really painful for her. I think that from an objective point of view, like, I think she is being too resistant, and I think she's being her own worst enemy in the way that she is continuing to cohabitate with them, and also continuing to be resistant to engaging with Glenn or the idea of Glenn in any capacity. And I also have a lot of sympathy for her, because I mean, like, goddamn, like, this is just such a horrible situation to be in.
Yeah, I think both of them. Because
it's so clear that like she like says later, and we'll get to it, but like she still really loves him, you know. And they built a whole life together and everything, and it's just tough. It's tough. It was very moving to watch this scene, because Angela fucking killed it this episode.
I was feeling a little more sympathetic to Michael than I usually do in this scene, even though I really feel for both of them. There's a great Angela Bassett moment where, like, he tries to put his hands on her shoulders and she just kind of, like, flinches away from it. Good scene. But we get the setup that this whole situation is not going well, basically. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He does this really interesting thing where, almost like in an effort to humanize Glenn to Athena, he kind of gives a little biography on him.
Right.
Like, he's like a contractor we met on this project. He barely drinks. He's like a good guy. All that stuff. Because Athena is like made like a passing remark about like running a background check on him or mm-hmm. something like that. And it's clear that, you know, Michael is like really trying to meet her where she is in this moment.
Mm-hmm. But we cut to the another 911 call. This,
oh my God,
this is a great call. The woman calls on the phone. She's like, "Help! My boss is burning up." And the dispatcher's like, "He has a fever," and she's like, "No, that is not what I mean."
Mm-hmm.
And we get to this gym, and this woman's like, "My boss is in the tanning bed, and I don't know how long he's been in there, but he's like literally burning alive." And I have to say, Final Destination 3. Like, very explicitly. Come on.
All I could think of.
Of course.
Those poor girls. This is a very LA thing for, like, this sort of high-end gym to have a tanning bed in it.
Mm-hmm.
And his skin is, like,
it's like covered in blisters. Yeah.
Fried.
It's like fully second degree burns, at least all over his body. Yeah.
Really gross.
Yeah, it's a very gross scene.
Viscerally. Ugh.
Viscerally gross. Bobby's like, "Is he dead?" And Chimney's like, "Worse. I think he's alive." Mm-hmm. They think maybe he had a stroke and, fell asleep in the tanning bed or whatever.
Yeah.
And they ask if he's doing drugs. Turns out he's on steroids. So that might have been why. Mm-hmm. And then at one point, I think he like flatlines and Hen's trying to give him chest compressions and his skin just like sloughs off on her hand.
Yeah.
That was bad.
A great precursor to that one scene in Lone Star that everyone's seen on Twitter.
I also thought of that. Yeah, the frozen guy and just hands go straight through his chest. Amazing. That's like, I still have not worked up the courage to watch Lone Star, like the motivation to watch it. But the only times when I really want to are when I think about that scene and I'm like, I would like to see that entire call.
Maybe just watch the call. I don't know.
True, I could do that. But then we find out from the employee who found him. She's like, "Man, this is so ironic," or something, like, because of what happened with his dog.
Mindy.
Mindy. Yeah. And we do another flashback. There are lots of flashbacks in this episode.
Interesting to name the dog Mindy, first of all.
Why?
It's just one of those weird person names you give an animal. It's
I don't think I've ever met
a pet named Mindy.
No.
It's like, because I have a dog named Stella, right? And like, that's like, it's like cute. It's like, whatever, it's like, it's what a sweet name for a dog. But maybe it's like looking at a baby and going like Phyllis,
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a cat named Stanley. He's on the bed with me right now.
Yeah, but that's funny.
It is funny to name a cat Stanley. Anyway, so we cut to a flashback, and basically like a week ago or maybe even just yesterday, I forget, the boss is pulling into work and he leaves his little dog in his car as he's about to go in the gym, and the employee comes up. She's like, "You can't just do that. It's hot out. The dog's gonna roast in there." And he's like, "It's fine. It's 70 degrees out. I've got the window cracked." And she starts like citing PETA.
He's got water,
She's like, "A car on a 70 degree day can get up to 100 degrees inside." And she's really upset. The guy is being very callous. Mm-hmm. He doesn't care. He's like, "I'm just doing chest."
"I'm just doing chest." And we see him on the bench, when she goes back inside. But it's like, I'm sorry. Do you have any like distaste for like any one group of non-marginalized people? Because for me, it's definitely these douchebag gym bros.
Any distaste for any group of non-marginalized people? Yeah, I would say like gym bros would be maybe one of those.
This guy is
a great question,
like the perfect.
I'm going to ask everybody that question at like Thanksgiving this week.
Right.
Conversation starter. It's like,
I really don't care for pilots. no, I mean, like, this guy, he's just the perfect archetype of this kind of, like, just callous, mm-hmm. like, whatever kind of guy. And he's the manager, too. He's her boss. And so she goes inside. She gets one of those, like, exercise balls or whatever. And mm-hmm.
and she does the right thing. Oh, also, while she's going back to the car, we get a bit of continuity where one of the other employees comes in and she like mentions, oh yeah, the tanning bed's on the fritz, and he's like, just jiggle right. it, you know, the timer.
They said like the timer keeps getting stuck.
Yeah, and it's like, okay, so continuity internally. Continuity. Good writing.
Great job, writing, Kristen.
And then she takes the fucking exercise ball and smashes his window mm-hmm. and takes his dog out of the car. And, you know, he fires her and everything.
He says, pick up your last paycheck tomorrow. So I guess that's why she was in the gym.
What a goddamn queen. Like, seriously.
Yeah, yeah. She is passionate about animal rights. But the next day, you know, karma's a bitch. This guy mm-hmm. fell victim to the broken tanning bed. Yeah. And he dies, I think.
He dies. Yeah, he does. He flatlines because of his stroke. And I just think this episode is like a perfect like time capsule of 2018 and all the conversations that were happening around then. Because I remember in 2018, the fucking leaving your dog in a hot car. Like there were like BuzzFeed articles about it. There were like,
really?
Like it was a point of conversation.
I thought that had always been kind of a conversation or.
Maybe that's just when I keyed into it. But I remember like hearing about that and then watching this episode and it's like, oh, interesting. So we're
listening.
Yeah,
so I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if it was. If that was a big thing in 2018, I'm sure that's where they got the inspiration from.
And so Hen goes to say karma's a bitch and Chim stops her.
Because I guess she's just saying that too much.
She's saying it too much.
It might have been the next one or something. But
I think it was the next one, yeah.
And at the end of this call, Bobby is like, you know, they're getting ready to get back in the truck. And Bobby gets a phone call from the doctor. And he tells everybody, you know, they say they found something in my blood. And they want to tell me in person. So everybody's like, oh boy, like Bobby must be like dying or something. I have to say, as we learn later, it's actually not a bad thing. It's a positive thing. I feel like if you're the doctor on the phone and you're like, no, I won't tell you until I can tell you in person. Yeah. I feel like you should at least establish that like, oh, you're not like dying or anything. I have some good news about your blood. Like, because how are you gonna, you've got to know as a doctor that if you say, we found something in your blood and I don't want to tell you over the phone. I need you to come in person. It's going to make someone think they're dying.
Assuming it's the same doctor, we see him later in the episode and like he opens the conversation in like the exact same way. And it's like,
he's got a problem.
How are you fucking like, how long have you been working at this? Is this your first day?
Like, I wrote down that he's like the doctor from Arrested Development. Did you watch that show?
I did watch it. I don't remember exactly what scene you're talking about.
There's like a running gag where somebody will get injured and they'll go to the hospital and there's this doctor who has this problem where he always opens stuff by saying like, we lost him. And they're like, oh my God. And then they're like, no, we can't find him. He went out the window or something. And like and they just hate him for that. So this doctor was exactly like that.
No, very much so. But we don't see the doctor yet. Instead, we get Bobby going to church, as he often does.
Bobby
and the
hot
gay
priest
returns.
Having a little heart-to-heart, as they often do.
So, yes, the hot priest. The hot priest, yes. Not
hot gay priest.
Hot gay priest. Okay, I saw other people saying that he was a gay priest because of the way he was flirting with Eddie in like episode 6, Confessions. And I was like, yes.
So we called that?
I have been right. I have been right this whole time.
Yes.
But the gay priest is back. The hot priest is back. The hot gay priest is back.
Of course.
And Bobby's worried he's going to die before he can repay his debt to society that he feels he's owed that is established.
We get his the real darker side of his psyche here, where he basically confesses that he, you know, he has his little book of all the lives he's saved, and he's trying to get up to 148, is it? The people who died.
I think it's 148, yeah. Mm-hmm. He's got 62 so far.
The people who died in the apartment fire, he's trying to make up every single one of those lives. And he basically says to his priest, like, when I'm done with that, then I can go. Then I can kill myself. And the priest is obviously taken aback by that.
Yeah.
And Bobby says, you know, God must have a sense of humor because now he's trying to, you know, depending on what the results of this blood test are, maybe I'm going to die before I get a chance to repay that debt. So Bobby is like, Bobby's got some real stuff going on in this episode.
I will say there's something interesting about this conversation, which is that, you know, the implication is that he's going to kill himself. And the priest brings up, you know, that suicide is like a mortal sin. It's like one of the most, it's one of the greatest transgressions you can do against God in like Catholicism and everything, right? Mm-hmm. And like he says, like, that'll cost you your eternal soul. And thinking maybe for Bobby, like, his sort of karmic justice in his own sense would be that maybe he deserves to burn mm-hmm. in hell for eternity, right? Like his family burned up, like he burned them alive and
burned their little choked bodies.
Them on, yeah, and choked them on smoke.
It's like Bobby is so mentally ill that he is not even a good Catholic anymore.
Yeah, no, this is a very mentally ill man.
Yeah, please, somebody get him some therapy.
But I was just thinking, like, Catholicism is, like, crazy. Like, but I feel like, I feel like the church has to take some blame in this. Because, like, I mean, he's thinking like this. And it's not all their fault, but...
You have to wonder if maybe his guilt would not be so intense had he not been so dedicated to his... to Catholicism, but I don't know.
Yeah, just an idea.
Yeah, he confesses that, and then we go to big tone shift once again.
Big tone shift.
Cut to, first of all, Instant Karma by John Lennon, and woman is a porch pirate. We see kind of a montage of her going to a bunch of different houses and stealing packages off the porch that have just been delivered, and finally on her last one, she's carrying like a big package, and she like trips on the bottom step of the house or something, and she
falls deserved.
And, you know, breaks something. So she calls 911. Help, I've fallen and I can't get up.
And I can't get up. I broke my fucking hip. Jesus
Christ.
Yeah,
she thinks she broke her hip. The pen and chimney get there. They're working on her. And she's like, can we just go to the hospital? Like, the package really isn't important. I just want to get out of here, because she knows she's in trouble. And Athena rolls up in her squad car. So she kind of knows he's been caught. And Athena's like, one of the neighbors called me. You're the porch pirate. Like, we've been knowing about you.
I don't know if it's just because... I had a package stolen recently.
Ooh, really?
But I hated her so much.
It's a very annoying, I mean, obviously on purpose, it's a very annoying type of crime and annoying mm-hmm. type of person.
A very annoying type of person. And so I feel like it's like, it's a good fit for you're creating this sort of like one-off villain character, right? But like, there is a pathos to her because, you know, she gets confronted about it and she says, I don't even keep them. I just like taking them. I'm supposed to go to rehab in Arizona, but they won't take my insurance plan.
She's a kleptomaniac.
Like, oh, wait, I kind of get her though.
It's
like,
a mental illness for sure.
Therapists definitely haven't taken my insurance in the past, you know? Mm. Like, that was actually a really smart addition, because if they had left that out, then she would have just been like the worst person on the planet.
Yeah, but it's a pretty funny call.
Yeah, but it's so, oh man, it's so funny.
This was when I wrote in my notes, like, this is the first episode that feels like true 911 to me, because I think it was something about the nature of this call just felt so like classic zany 911 call. Mm-hmm.
She just needs a more productive outfit.
Yeah. She should start shoplifting and giving to the poor.
Yeah, you know, Robin Hood, you know, like, or just like, even just like at home, she could be, you know, writing fanfic or going to the club or something.
She could
I don't know.
Doing all of those things.
She needs to I'm not gonna therapize her. She go to that rehab, girl. Get on Aetna or whatever.
Yeah.
It was a really funny scene. You're right. It did feel classic, and I thought that her like trying to urge Hen and Chim to like take her to the hospital. She's like, "Why aren't we going to the hospital?" They're like, "You could have a spine thing going on or something like that." And then it turns out she's gonna be charged with grand theft and trespassing.
Yikes!
It's just one of those like light calls to, I guess, lighten the mood, because Bobby's Catholic guilt was getting very, very heavy.
Right. Well, speaking of Bobby's Catholic guilt, we then go to another Bobby scene where he and Chimney are now at the doctor.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I also did write down during this scene, do we think the doctor thought Chim and Bobby were husbands?
I think so.
Because Chimney is there for moral support, and the doctor comes in and he's like, you know, he says something like, this might be intense, or like, you might want to sit down or whatever, and Bobby's like, anything you say to me you can say to him. Like,
he looks at Chim and he's like, yeah, it's like a whole thing. It's a whole moment.
So I would just assume like, oh, that's his partner.
Yeah. Well, it's LA. I feel like you should assume, because I feel like the odds are definitely not unlikely.
Chobby
but it
moment.
Turns out chobby moment.
I'm sorry, but like, as people can probably tell, one of my favorite jokes is just making terrible ship names for things I don't actually intend to ship. It's why I'm so obsessed with Kenny Choi doing this joke where he and Eddie are called Chetty. He's been doing that lately, and I'm on board.
But Chobby is like rancid. That's like a.
I know. It's either Chobby or Bobney.
Bobney just sounds like a Bobby Chimney Maddie like thruple.
Kind of does, which I don't even want to think about that. But no. Chimby.
Chimby. Wait, Chimby. That's so cute. Chimby is cute. But it turns out this tactless doctor once again buries the lead.
Yeah.
And it turns out like Bobby has a rare sort of genetic makeup in that his blood is like a cure-all for a rhesus disease.
I think it was rhesus disease. But you guys need to understand the way he introduces this. What we mean by him burying the lead is he goes, do you guys, have you heard of rhesus disease? And they're like, no. And he's like, well, it's usually fatal. And it's like this terrible disease. And they're like, oh, God, so I have that. And he's like, no. It only affects pregnant women and their fetuses. And they're like, okay, so why did you tell us that? And yeah, then he reveals that Bobby's blood type matches almost exactly this Australian guy who for many years donated blood to save these people, because I guess they need blood transfusions to cure it, and you need like a very specific type of blood. So they're like, Bobby, yeah, you could save all of these babies with your golden blood.
It's like a really odd genetic mutation where your like plasma in your blood contains antibodies against RHD. I'm reading this from Wikipedia, by the way.
Great.
And so
I figured, like, I was like, damn, how do you know so much about this?
And so he like regularly donated for like years, like a lot of years, and he like saved like he made like almost 1,200 donations.
Wow, he must have had to eat a lot of cookies.
And he lived to be like 87.
Wow.
Apparently Bobby is like an almost like perfect like genetic match for this guy, which means that like it's this strange cosmic joke where Bobby was so worried that he wasn't going to be able to live to fulfill this debt that he feels that he owes, and now it's like, oh, he has the capacity to go above and beyond that with like just the essence of who he is, and even that feels like a. But he has to live.
He can't kill himself because that would be immoral now.
Yeah. And it's even like there's also like even a little like character thing where like he's defined himself for so long now, like 5 years as like the guy that killed all those people. And now just by being who he is and by his own essence, he can be the guy that saves so many more. Like literal babies.
I think that in itself makes him feel kind of wretched, because knowing Bobby, I think he probably kind of feels like he doesn't deserve almost to have this natural gift that will make him such a like superhero. Like you kind of get that vibe, like the doctor like congratulates him and you can see that Bobby doesn't look very happy. I think he's not just thinking about the fact that now he has to keep living kind of for the good of the world, but also that he's being sort of ascribed this like inherent goodness that he doesn't feel like he actually has,
and it creates this like huge internal turmoil within him. And you know, we get a glimpse of it now, but it's gonna really come to a head later on.
I do want to say I think it's absolutely hilarious that, for the record, this storyline never comes up ever again. In the entire show. Bobby being a golden blooded boy who apparently we are told needs to donate blood once every 8 weeks for the rest of his life. We never even hear reference to that ever again. No. And I think that is so camp of 911, and I support it.
It really felt like the writers were kind of getting sick of Bobby wanting to kill himself and use this as a very elaborate excuse to try and write that away, maybe.
I guess, maybe. It's just really funny. I would love to see like one reference to it someday in the show. Like, oh, I can't that day. I have to go give my like government mandated blood donation.
Tim, if you're listening, season 8 finale, it'll be the best callback of all time.
Ooh, yeah. People will love you for that. We know you love a good callback, Tim Minear.
Bobby's like, I gotta go to my blood donation. Whoa! And he walks in on Buck and Eddie making out. But that's neither here nor there.
And scene.
And we go from that, the hospital, to this uncle, this man. He's an uncle, of course. And he's there at the zoo with his nephews. They're at the tiger exhibit.
I was loving this.
a very exciting exhibit, of course, whenever you're at the zoo, you get to see the tigers, the Bengal tigers.
To quote Oliver Stark in Celebrity Family Feud, Tiger.
Is that how he says his R's?
Yeah, I mean, in this episode of Celebrity Family Feud, at least, there's a moment right. where he says very forcefully, he says, Tiger. Anyway, just take my word for it.
I love that, man. I still haven't watched it. How have I not watched the 911 Family Feud episode?
It's pretty great.
That's just one that escaped me.
They're very bad at it, and they somehow win anyway, which makes it feel like the game was rigged.
Oh, that does. But, oh, no. That's like the New Directions beating the Trouble Tones.
I think it might just be that Family Feud is a flawed game wherein you can be doing really well and still lose because of like the way the game is set up. We're with this uncle and the two nephews, and they are being framed as like the most insufferable people on the planet. Episode, it kind of reminds me of that episode in season 2 that's called Awful People, and just all the calls, the theme of the episode is that we're following all these awful people. It's kind of the same in this episode. Because this guy, the nephews are like on their phones and they're trying to get a good picture of the tiger, but they're like, oh, the tiger's not doing anything. Like, let's throw stuff at it. Yeah. And the uncle,
it's like
instead
out of sight or something, it's behind the tree. It's like,
yeah,
obscured.
It's like lying down. Mm-hmm. But instead of like telling them to knock it off, the uncle's like, yeah, I'll throw stuff at it too. So he like picks up these pine cones, starts just pelting them at the tiger. You know, this woman comes over and, like, scandalized, just like, are you throwing things at that tiger? You can't do that. But they're like, oh, it's fine. It's my nephew just wanted to get a picture, you know, like, as if that is an excuse. So they, like, move on. The uncle goes to the bathroom.
Yeah.
And he starts to hear screaming. And he gets back outside. Everybody's running away. The tiger has somehow broken out of its enclosure and is now just, like, wandering through the zoo. And
you know, it never forgets a face.
Oh, no. That tiger was like, you know what? You pissed me off today.
A man who hits me in the face and body with a pine cone? You better run.
The tiger was like, I wasn't planning to break out of my enclosure, but, you know, you messed with the wrong tiger.
With the wrong tiger.
So, you know, the tiger sees him. It's just one-on-one. And yeah, this guy knows he's fucked. So he calls 911. Abby's like, you know, I'm being told you should stay very still. Stay where you are. But this guy's an idiot. So he runs away as fast as he can.
Somehow makes it to a fence.
Yeah, he somehow manages to get into the flamingo enclosure. But then he realizes that tigers are very powerful animals who can climb things. Yeah. So
we'll say, though, flamingo enclosure, great place to be just in general. Like, I feel like
I would love
it
to be in a flamingo enclosure right now. Queening out with some of those girls.
Yes. It's just like he said he's been on safari before. It's like alluding to something. He's been on safari and he knows how fast the animal is, and he still runs for some fucking reason.
We're getting the sense that this is not a smart man.
No. But then the 118 rolls up, and we hear that the handler tried to handle the situation when the tiger got out, and it and the tiger performed a very meticulous surgical procedure.
Yeah, the tiger
called degloving.
Yikes.
Rip the skin off his arm.
Right, but he says something like, you know, he didn't want to hurt me. I've known Kobe since he was a cub. He's like,
Tiger's name is Kobe.
Yeah, that's what he says.
Tiger's name is Kobe.
He's like, he didn't want to hurt me. He was just scared, whatever.
I know it was like probably a reference to Kobe Bryant, but because like tigers can jump and whatever, I don't know. But I want it to be true. Did you ever see that American Idol audition with that girl named Kobe? And she comes in, and Katy Perry's on the panel, and she goes, my name's Kobe, and Katie goes, like the beef. And
I have not seen that. But
I'm going to send you the clip, because the audition itself is insane.
I haven't seen it, but I was also thinking about the beef during this scene.
Yeah, and I got to say, first of all, strong Harambe vibes with this scene.
Kind
of culturally relevant-ish at the point this episode was produced.
Man, come to think of it, I'm surprised they never did like a directly inspired Harambe call.
Yeah. But then it flashes back to like who this guy is. Hen like recognizes the name.
Right. Well, what happens is they hear from the dispatcher that like there's another person in distress who had called 911. And so
the dispatcher, her name is Abby Clark.
Well, I kind of forgot if it was still Abby or if it was someone else. Who's Abby? Yeah. So Abby's like, you know, there's this other guy. What's his name? Who was on the line with me and apparently was cornered by the tiger. And yeah, Hen's like, wait, that can't be the same. What's his name? Who was a dentist who was a poacher? And we get, great little flashback of this dentist being like, you know, there are mobs of angry people outside his office, like protesting because he apparently poached a beloved lion who was like being tracked by researchers when he was on his aforementioned safari. Yeah. So he like
the
gets into his
name
office.
Is Ellie. It's like
Ellie. He gets into his office. And he pulls, like, the giant taxidermied head of Ellie the Lion out of a box. And this is when we get the you ought to know needle drop, by the way.
Yeah, I just have written in my notes, because I completely forgot that this was the backstory of this call. And so I just have written down, oh my god, it's Cecil the Lion. That was something...
Yeah, I was trying to remember what the true story there was, because I remember there was something like that.
Oh, yeah. I remember, like, I was still on Facebook at the time that that story broke, and I remember just how forced to hear about that whole thing I was. But I still, to this day, don't know the names of anyone involved. I just know there was a dentist, he went on safari, he killed a lion that was apparently famous. But I had never even heard of Cecil the Lion before he was horribly murdered.
Famous in lion terms might be, like, a little more niche than, like a rock star or something.
But, like, I've heard of Simba, you know?
Well, that is not a real lion.
You take Cecil, that the fuck back.
Oh, man. Cecil was born in 2002, so he was younger than us. That's sad.
Okay.
Cecil was a male African lion who lived primarily in the Hwange National Park. I'm probably not saying that right. Anyway, he was being studied and tracked by the University of Oxford, which they say a similar thing in the episode. Apparently, he was lured out of the protected area and wounded with an arrow by Walter Palmer. An American
with an
recreational
arrow?
With an arrow, it says.
He was bow hunting a fucking lion.
That is crazy.
Oh my god.
It says he tracked and killed him with a compound bow the following morning. Damn.
Jesus Christ.
Palmer had purchased a hunting permit and was not charged legally with any crime. Mm-hmm. But it, resulted in international media attention and outrage among animal conservationists, obviously.
And so we get that context for this in-universe character, because obviously it's the dentist who killed Cecil the Lion. It's that guy. But he's in the universe, so he killed a different lion just as beloved, seemingly.
Basically, back at the zoo, we see that this tiger has laid waste to this guy. We see like the people packing up his quote body, and it's like he's in pieces.
He's in pieces. He's like he got torn to fucking shreds.
They've got bags of chunks of him. Essentially, is all that's left. And you know what? I'm on Team Tiger. So
I am too. Team Tiger. They
team
gave
Kobe.
Us all that backstory. Team Kobe Beef. they gave us that whole backstory just so that we could understand just how much of a piece of shit this guy is.
Just so that we could be incredibly satisfied when we find out he's been ripped to absolute shreds.
Yeah.
And I respect that.
I respect it too. I like that we got a little like maybe even kind of a small nod to the raptor scene, because like when we come back, he's like still alive and he's like, I think I outsmarted it. And then he turns around and the tiger's just fucking there.
Tiger's right there. Yeah, it does feel a little Jurassic Park.
I will say this would have been a great time for a needle drop of the song Maneater.
That would have been great.
Whoa, here she comes. She's a man-eater.
Or, knowing this show, may I suggest Eye of the Tiger? Because they're so unsubtle about it.
Oh my god.
Like, they would do that. I'm surprised they didn't.
That's amazing. Wait, that would have been amazing. Kristen, if ever you want to revisit this plot, just take the notes.
Kobe gets his revenge in season 9.
Yeah, and he gets tranked instead of shot, so it's not a Harambe thing. He gets tranked, and like Athena like mentions that he might have to be put down, but then Hen says, "Nah, that was karmic justice. Society's going to be on the tiger's side."
Yeah, which clearly we are. So yeah, probably right about that.
Definitely. And then we cut back to the Grant household. And Athena's on her way to work, but she goes up to either May or Harry's room. I think it's May's room.
Yeah, they're like both hanging out together.
Yeah, they're just like straight chilling. And she's like, you know, Dad's downstairs. Do you want to go hang out with them? And they have a heart to heart about basically like they say, you know, we're not mad at Dad for being gay. We're mad at you guys for still being together.
Yeah, like, why did you think that keeping us all here under this roof when you're mad at each other all the time would be the right thing to do or the best thing for us? I gotta say, the kids are showing an almost unrealistic level of emotional intelligence in this scene. But I like that they went so textbook with it, kind of like, as we've talked about before, kind of like the Degrassi thing of just like, let's like do the research and find out what the right thing to do is here, and let's have the characters very explicitly spell it out.
Yeah, because May was asking like the real questions, you know, and it was honestly like, I feel like, okay, again, I'm going to talk about this without projecting my own life experiences onto the story.
Okay.
But I think she spilled. She spilled.
Absolutely.
And because like as a kid, especially as a teenager, you can't live in a house with two parents who hate each other. You can't do it. It's impossible.
And I think that's a common impulse that like parents will, parents who are breaking up essentially will think like, we need to stay together for the kids, when really, that's really not an ideal situation to be in as a kid. So,
And I loved that one line that she said, because it just, I don't know, it spoke to me. She said, we prefer honesty. Isn't that what you always taught us?
Yeah. And it's kind of just like in any of these situations, the best scenario is to just be honest and not try and like keep up appearances or whatever.
And it was a real moment of like perspective, like necessary perspective for Athena. It was good to see, honestly. It was really, I thought it was a really well done scene. I know it was like super textbook, but honestly, like with how dense, like speaking as someone who is now an adult and can put myself in both of their shoes, sometimes you need it spelled out for you.
I think it was still good. And I like to see, it's like I called it Degrassi style. I love Degrassi for that very reason.
Oh my God. Yeah. Famous Degrassi haters, the both of us.
Right?
Famous.
We've never
people...
even watched that show.
We never. What show? I don't even know what that is. But we cut from that scene to Bobby lifting.
Bobby's angrily pumping iron. I loved this. Chimney is kind of still trying to celebrate what he perceives as this big win for Bobby, that he gets to save all these people, and Bobby is clearly not doing well about it. He's not having a good time.
There's talk of the Presidential Medal of Freedom.
Yes. Chimney's trying to be like, this guy like won a big government award for this. Maybe you could get the Presidential Medal of Freedom. And obviously that is not what Bobby needs to hear right now. It's more of what we were talking about of like people thrusting this sort of goodness upon Bobby that he doesn't think he deserves.
Yeah. Although to offer an alternative interpretation, you know, Bobby's a very progressive man. Maybe he just didn't want it because of who the president was.
Oh, true. He was like, you are not sending me to Trump's White House to get a medal.
Oh, God.
I forgot that this is a Trump-era show. That's so wild. Yeah. Maybe it'll get good again now that we're in another Trump
going
era.
Back into it.
I've had this thought before, to be quite honest.
It'll galvanize the writing room in a way. You know, it will.
Like, this is what the world needs now.
It'll be the last push we really need to make buddy canon.
I hate to say it. I said this before, that maybe this was some sort of Faustian bargain, and this is just the way it has to be.
But if this is the timeline we're in, then, you know, we're in it.
I don't know if it's worth it, but I'll take the buddy canon, like, as a consolation prize for sure.
It's the saddest consolation prize. It's, oh my God, it's just the idea of that is so condescending. I'm pissing myself off.
Yeah, your world may be in flames, but hey, we got these two guys to kiss each other.
But we get, like, you know, Bobby gets so worked up, and Chim, like, keeps, like, pressing him on it. He gets so worked up that he, like, just spells it out. He says, I don't want to save those kids. I want to save my kids, and I'll never be able to.
My kids. Oh, it's so good. It's so emotional. Mm-hmm. And he admits to Chimney, similarly as he admitted to the priest, that he wants to kill himself. You know, Chimney says, yeah. like, you're not talking about killing yourself. And Bobby's like, yeah. He just says, yeah.
I am. Okay, so what you said about the acting a couple episodes ago with Peter Krause.
Right.
I'm kind of feeling it in this scene.
It occurred to me... However, I thought it worked better in this scene than, like, the other ones I've pointed out.
It's just, like, I don't know what it is about this scene in particular. There's just something about the frankness of it Okay, we know he can do, like, really deep, you know, emotionally raw performances. And we know he can be subtle as well. And we also know that he can be very unsubtle. And he can also... be kind of, he can have a unique spin on it, right?
Yeah.
I think it might be a directorial problem.
Oh, it could be, yeah.
I really think it is. I think I would have directed him differently in this scene.
Interesting. I felt like the frankness was actually working for me in this one. Like, there are, like I've said, there are some scenes where it comes off to me as, like, a little, like, taking me out of it, the way he's kind of almost like matter-of-factly saying these things. I thought in this scene, maybe because they were framing him as like really angry, I feel like him being sort of short and like flippant about it was kind of working for me.
Yeah. But if that was the case, maybe I would have just like, maybe it was just the tone of his voice. I don't know. He has, I think I said this a couple episodes ago, but he has a very unique speaking voice.
It's his Minnesota nice.
It's the Minnesota nice.
But you know, it's all, it depends on how you see, you know, the Bobby is in the eye of the beholder. Obviously,
of course,
we can we can feel differently about various Bobby scenes, but yeah, this one worked decently enough for me.
Yeah, it's there's something else that's kind of odd about this scene, which is that, and this also might just be a me thing, but back in the scene with the gay hot priest, as he has come to be known,
of course,
I got the impression that Bobby was almost like accepting of his fate if he didn't get into heaven in his Catholic way, right? I thought it was almost like building to the idea that he thought hell would be a fitting punishment for what he did, and there was sort of like a karmic moment with that. But here he's saying, I want to be with my kids. I want to kill myself so I can be with my family.
Yeah. I guess the hell thing hadn't even really occurred to me in that first scene, so maybe I just wasn't seeing it like that. But yeah, I mean, it's like I said, he's like so mentally ill that his Catholicism is like not even really, like the waters are muddied. And I wonder if he's just not thinking super rationally about any of this stuff because he is so like depressed and struggling. And if there's any inconsistency in his view of it here, I feel like it's probably, you can't really expect rationality from his mindset right now, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
But ultimately, I love this scene. I love the chobby bond we're seeing in this episode. And this scene especially just feels so like, I remember in like one of my first watch throughs when I was taking notes for my video, like one of my first notes about this episode was just that I like all the wholesome male bonding on this show. And I was specifically thinking of this scene. And I think another Chimney Bobby scene from like season two. And I love to see it. I love that, you know, for all jokes aside, this isn't like, these two guys are completely platonic and they have this really special bond. So that's also like when people try and dismiss like gay shipping because they're like, why can't two men just be friends in me? Like what's, why
they
can't
are.
We have, why can't
they
we
are.
Have positive representation of male friendships? And it's like, well, we do like literally with other characters on this show. Like there's no, I don't know what genius came up with this idea that there's like a dearth of representation of platonic straight male friendships in movies and TV. Cause that has never been my experience. But
Scott and Stiles found dead in the street. Like it's like any show that has a positive relationship between two characters, it's probably going to be between the guys. Because like if there's one thing a lot of TV show writers like doing, it's making all of the women hate each other.
Right.
You know, and so like if there is like positive friendships to be found,
a lot of the time it's between two guys, you know, or like a group of guys.
I could sort of see maybe what those people are getting at is like, oh, there's not a lot of representation of positive male friendships that are like free of toxic masculinity, maybe, or that are like allowed to be truly intimate or whatever. But then I would just show them, like in this show specifically, there are cases of that, like right here. So whatever. But basically, I think this scene is really special.
I feel like I totally agree for all those reasons. And I feel like even with that, like, I feel like that's kind of moving the goalpost, is like, yeah. Is the problem that men aren't friends, or is it that they're not allowed to be like be vulnerable with each other? That's just a critique of like masculinity and the way that sort of patriarchal masculinity manifests in male friendships. That's societal.
That you do not have to bring that into the gay shipping.
No, I don't think people wanting two boys to kiss is the reason for patriarchal masculinity
ruining male friendships. If we just got rid of all these gay people, men could finally be vulnerable with each other. Please,
honestly,
God.
but that probably is how a lot of like, especially straight guys feel. They'll have like this homophobia where they feel like, I want to be like close with my guy friends, but I don't want them to think I'm gay. It's like high school level paranoia. And it's meanwhile, all of these men have like wives. And listen, I'm not saying every man who has a wife isn't gay. All I'm saying is that you don't have to compensate for anything. Like, if you're not gay, then you're not gay.
I just
want
to single out one of your lines here again, which is, I don't mean to say that every man who has a wife isn't gay. It's technically true, but a funny sentence to say.
It is. It did. I just heard it now coming from you, and I'm like, wait, did I say that right?
I'm not saying that every man with a wife isn't gay.
Hey, Tommy. Hey.
I was thinking more Michael. But we go from there to Athena and Hen are meeting up on a call. Hen is using like cola to wash blood off the street. It's like a little life hack she's figured out. Side note,
not even
I
a
love
specific
in...
cola.
No, I was going to say I love in movies and TV when like obviously I guess they don't have clearance to just say like Coke. So they say cola, which nobody says in real life. Yeah. When they're talking about Coke or Pepsi, but she's walking off the street with this. Athena comes over and they start talking a little about their rough home lives. Basically.
Can I sidebar very, very briefly about this in particular? What legal trouble could they possibly get in for just saying Pepsi, even if they don't even show the can? They're just like, we wash it off the pavement with Pepsi. It's like, what's Pepsi going to do?
Yeah. I'm not sure if it's like, not even so much worrying about legal trouble. Maybe it's almost like they don't want to give like free promotion to a brand. I really don't know. Maybe it's just considered like good practice to not name a specific brand if you can avoid it.
Right. Well, listen, we'll bring Kristen on the show and we'll ask her about it because we know she wrote this episode.
Oh my God, Kristen, if you're listening.
Come on the show, queen.
We are like your biggest fans in this fandom that has been so cruel to you for no reason.
And then we get to Hen, basically, she and Athena are, you know, they're having a little vibe on the job as they often do. Hen confesses that things are not going so well at home right now. Athena asks, personal or work? She goes, personal. And she goes, money or sex? And says, sex. Like, I think she whispers it. And then she confesses to Athena that she and Eva slept together.
Yeah, there's a good dynamic between her and Athena here where, like, Hen is feeling really bad, but she also is kind of feeling like, I don't want to tell Karen, like, I'll never do it again. And Athena is, like, not, she doesn't have a lot of sympathy for Hen right now, like, given what's been going on with her at home. She, I think, is identifying more with Karen in this situation, obviously. So she's like, for one thing, clearly, if you cheated, like, there are problems in your relationship and you need to address that.
You don't cheat on a healthy relationship.
She's saying also, like, like, if you want any fighting chance of fixing this, like, you need to tell her, you need to be honest. And it's interesting, it ties back to the previous Athena scene with her kids where they said, like, you know, you always told us honesty is the best policy. So
yep.
that's kind of fresh mm-hmm. in her mind, maybe. And mm-hmm. yeah, she basically tells her to just come clean.
Yeah. She's voicing things in this scene that seem to pertain back to her relationship with Michael. And yeah. it's like she's got that perspective from May coming in, and now she's voicing this to Hen while in her head maybe working through a couple of things in her own. It's effective. It's actually a really smart way to tie in both storylines together. Because there are a lot of parallels there. Kristen, come on, Kristen.
The writer that you are.
And then we go from that, of course, you know, Hen's left to stew on that. And we go from that to Michael fell asleep reading a book, right?
Yeah, Athena comes home to find him on the couch, and she decides to just finally have the conversation with him.
Yeah, it seems like he's kind of waiting up for her, in a sense.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe, or maybe he was just reading. I don't know. Maybe he just likes to read. She comes down, they're finally going to have an adult conversation about this, and she gives him the name and number of her divorce attorney.
Yeah, she's Thank like, God. I want to do this while I still love you,
yeah.
because doing this is making me hate you, like living in this house and just pretending things are normal and trying to make it work. Mm-hmm. And they have a very long conversation, and I think just a good one about, like, I have to say, it's weird to me that Michael is the one in this situation who's, like, pushing back on it. Like, I kind of feel like after all this, like, Michael should have been the one pushing for the divorce because, you know, we kind of get the feeling early on that, like, you know, like in that therapy scene when Michael wants to keep dating other people, but Athena doesn't. It's like she's sort of a little deluded about what this is, you know, yeah. and
mm-hmm.
I feel like it was just weird to me that Michael was like immediately kind of pushing back on the idea of getting a divorce. It's like, dude, you are like practically moved out, like dating yeah. another person for months. Like, obviously you guys need to get a divorce.
Yeah, that part. I don't know. Maybe there is still a part of him that clings to the sort of like the intimacy and the comfort of their marriage. Obviously, you know, he still yeah. cares for her. Like she says, like, you know, you're my best friend. Like they obviously, like, we have like an actual moment of like sincerity and like
mm-hmm.
kindness between the two of them, which we haven't really had up until yeah. this point.
Also, it seems like Michael was under the impression that this arrangement was working maybe a little more than Athena was. And I do want to say, I think it's maybe in that scene with Athena and Hen earlier where Athena says something where she says, like, I feel like I'm doing the majority of the emotional heavy lifting here. And I'm glad she yeah. said that because I think it's very true. And I think it's you can so kind of see it in this scene where Michael is like, well, early on when in their first scene together, when he says something like, you know, everybody says they're doing the best thing for the kids and we are putting the kids first. And we really are, even though this arrangement mm-hmm. clearly is not best for the kids. And then later in this scene, when he's like pushing back against the idea of getting a divorce, it seems like for him, he doesn't want to do that because, you know, he's not really the one having to bear the brunt of like the difficulty of all this, like Athena is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like she said, it's yeah, like he's coming and going and he's in a new relationship and she just kind of has to be there in the role she's always been in and kind of still be his wife. Like you said, like there's, like you said, he might be still seeking that intimacy from her. It's like, it kind of makes it feel, I hate to toss around the term emotional labor because I think that's sort of a pseudo, you know, therapy talk kind of thing that people use a lot. But it feels like, yeah, he's kind of asking, yeah. implicitly asking her to keep doing this stuff.
I think it applies here, definitely. I mean, like, this is taking like a real toll on her, you know what I mm-hmm. mean? And like in this sort of moment of her finally like, you know, taking initiative to step out of that and like break out of this horrible cycle that they found themselves in, you know, we see an affection, you know,
mm-hmm.
for him within her, you know, and yeah. it's like, this is a real kindness that she's doing, you know, for herself, for the family and, you know, in a sense for him as well, you know, because like,
yeah.
neither of them are going to progress forward while they're still in the situation. And so
it definitely gives him more freedom to like pursue his relationship and be more committed to that.
And doing it without hurting her too, or without, I guess, mm-hmm. rubbing it in her face in a sense.
Yeah, without having to like have it be around her all the time, I guess.
Yeah.
She's like, you can be gay, but just don't shove it in my face all the time.
No, that's her GBF. That's her GBF. No regrets.
Yeah, he is now. He is now.
Mm-hmm. But God, this scene is just absolutely like amazing. Like Angela's acting in this scene is just mm-hmm. truly phenomenal.
Oh, I wanted to mention this moment in the Athena and Hen scene where it's just a little detail. Hen says, I slept with Eva, and you can see Angela Bassett from the back, like full body, like jump scare. She kind of just like recoils like she's been hit or something. I thought that was great.
Mm-hmm. She's present. She's present. She's in the moment.
Physical acting, yeah.
And then they basically bookend it with sort of like a one last kiss for the road sort of type thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's honestly, it's really sweet. And like, it's necessary, and it's the first step towards them actually building towards the healthy relationship that we see in later mm-hmm. seasons, you know?
Yeah, but then unfortunately we cut to the Wilson home, Hen coming home, and things are not so rosy in the Wilson home. She comes home, Karen is, like, ominously sitting at the dining room table, and she's like, you're late. Hen says, you know, I was driving, I was trying to get my thoughts in order. And Karen's like, about Eva? And she reveals that Eva is suing them for custody. And not
she, like,
only
plops
is she
a
suing
dossier
them for,
down.
Yeah, a huge, huge ream of paper down on the table. Mm-hmm. And not only is Eva suing them for custody, she is claiming that they have an unstable home environment. And she's mm-hmm. claiming this because she says she slept with Hen. So basically, Karen has already had this news broken to her, not by her wife, who she loves and trusts, but by this, like, third party that she finds evil, you know? So,
yeah.
Pretty rough.
I feel like if I was, like, a judge presiding over this case, like, the thing that I would be thinking the most, like, when seeing, like, Eva on one side, Hen and Karen on the other side, I'd just, like, be thinking, like, Eva's lawyer would be, like, being like, yeah, the wife had an affair with the other woman. And, mm-hmm. like, I would just be thinking, but you're the other woman.
Yeah. It's like you're damaging Hen's credibility, but are you not also damaging your own?
By saying, no.
I came in, I wrecked a home.
It's like people, like, posting screenshots where they're clearly the bad guy. It's like, yeah.
It's like, oh, why would you post this?
Yeah, but obviously, like, the purpose of this is just to sort of to torture Hen and Karen,
mm-hmm.
And also to actually properly destabilize their home environment, so she has a real like more of a tangible reason to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And it works, and Tracy Toms is acting the fuck out of this scene. She gets
so
one scene in this
great.
Episode, acting the fuck out of it, and she goes and she packs her shit.
Just, like, immediately gets you on her side. I mean, obviously you're on her side because she's been cheated on, but, like, she really sells it, I would say.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
She says she's taking Denny to her parents' house, I think.
Yeah. That's sort of where we leave that story. It's interesting that this whole storyline has been kind of happening in the background.
Yeah.
We only get, like, little snippets of it per episode.
Ugh, honestly, classic Hen and Karen getting sidelined, but
I know.
At least we got some attention this episode. I do think Kristen Rydell is, like, maybe one of Hen and Karen's, like, biggest mm-hmm. shooters in the writer's room. Because
she did give us the wedding episode, right?
Yeah, I think, as I pointed out in my video, like, I think she actually, most of Hen and Karen's biggest moments happened under her seasons. And I don't know, you get the sense that maybe that's a priority for her.
Yeah. Then we cut from there to the second to last scene of the episode,
mm-hmm.
which is Athena. She's out at a bar. She took herself to a movie and she wanted a drink before she went home. Right.
Very me and activity to do. Let me go to a movie alone and then drink alone.
And then a guy sends her a drink, classic, and mm-hmm. they catch a vibe. They really do. Mm-hmm. But the vibe is initiated by her info dumping about her relationship and her
life.
Info dumping
about her
man.
Relationship. And then she's like, what's your name and birth date and whatever? I'm going to do a background check on you because I'm a cop.
What what kind of riz is this?
Miraculously, this guy is not at all put off by that. And he's like, you know what? Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I mean, she is Angela Bassett, so, like, I get it.
I just want to cut to that clip of her in season 8 going, and that's no cap.
But this guy is Mr. Smooth, as he's been dubbed, and he's taking it all in stride. He's into it, and yeah, it's cute. It's cute.
It's cute. They kind of hit it off. And it's nice mm-hmm. to see Athena just, like, being, feeling valued again, maybe feeling desired again. Like, you want that for her.
Yeah, it's really nice, actually. It's nice to see her stepping out of her box of misery mm-hmm. that consists of horrible home life. And stressful right. job that's pretty all-consuming.
Yeah, getting tied up by a serial killer, etc. Mm-hmm.
And brutalizing whoever she may come across.
Right, that too.
I love the audacity of that, just running a background check on the guy you're talking to within 5 minutes of meeting him.
At least it's a good screener for, like, can they handle Athena's kind of whole mm-hmm. deal, you know?
Yeah, and it turns out...
Can they handle who she is?
This guy seems a little
this
into it.
This guy's down. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And like you said, it's Angie Bassett, so of course.
Of course. Understandable.
But we go from that to the last scene of the episode, which is Chim calls Bobby to the hospital. Obviously, he's concerned. More Chobby.
More Chobby.
More
Chimby. This is such a Chobby-heavy episode.
Very Chimby episode.
Chimby.
And he shows him... Basically, the pediatric, like, Reese's ward, they seem to have, like, a dedicated, like, space for the infants struggling with this. But mm-hmm. the blood that he donated at the blood drive was used to treat a little girl who would have died without it.
Yeah.
Her name's Asha.
Yeah, the dad of this baby comes up to them. I guess Chimney has told him that they were coming, and he, like, thanks Bobby, kind of says all this stuff about, like, we didn't think we'd get to meet our baby or whatever, and so... This is really one last thing to kind of try and show Bobby all the good he's doing.
Yeah. And we get like, I have to take note of this needle drop because we get one last, and it's a song by The Killers that I wasn't familiar with. And
I think I noticed this.
I like The Killers, but the way this song, like, it's like very much like not what you'd think of. It's not like Mr. Brightside or anything. It's not like Human or Spaceman or anything. It's mm-hmm. it's like a slowed down ballad. That's like wow. it's actually got strong Sufjan vibes.
Okay.
It immediately reminded me of the Sufjan Stevens song that they used in Call Me By Your Name when Timmy was like at the fireplace and crying and stuff like that for the credits.
Is it Mystery of Love? Or is that a different I only know of one Sufjan Stevens song in Call Me By Your Name.
Is that how you say it? Sufjan?
That is how I have always said it and heard it pronounced, but
it
I don't know
is.
For a fact.
Well, the reason I pointed out is because...
I'm a big Sufjan Stevens fan.
You are or you aren't?
I are.
Oh, okay. Never mind.
Is it the one that's like, oh, to see without my eyes?
No, I'm just like, I don't want to yuck your yum. I don't want to... because I hate Sufjan Stevens.
Oh, this is going to be a problem. I might have to stop doing this podcast. I'm not like a mega fan as in I've like listened to every song ever, but... Come on, Feel the Illinois is like the Illinois album is like an amazing album. And also I grew up listening to these songs because my older cousins would play them for us. And I was really into it. I have a very deep emotional connection with this music. And
that's fair. That's why I said I'm not yucking your yum. I'm not bringing it up. I was just like,
okay.
I was watching this scene and I was like, in my show? Are you kidding? But then it was The Killers. And I was like, okay. But, sorry.
That's insane that you don't like Sufjan Stevens. And I can't believe that's the note we're ending on. I'm going to send you a 25-minute song called Impossible Soul. You don't have to listen to the whole thing. You start it at around the 13-minute mark and just go through like the sort of upbeat part of the song. That song
what?
Is crazy.
What?
Yeah.
And the anime fan...
Everybody,
like,
everybody listening
skip
to this.
Skip the first 50 episodes.
I'm not saying
it
you
gets
have to
really
skip it. Like the whole thing is good, but me and my cousins and my sister's favorite part of it starts at the 13-minute mark, and it goes on for a few minutes, and that's kind of its own song. Anyway, everybody listening to this, go to your music listening app, whichever one you use, look up the Sufjan Stevens song Impossible Soul, go to about the 13-minute mark, and listen to the next, like, 4 or 5 minutes.
They're going to
do
it.
And you won't regret it.
They're gonna do it, and they're gonna drag me so hard for this. I'm just gonna keep my mouth shut.
They're gonna be like, I can't believe Ryan doesn't like this.
I know. Oh God, imagine how they feel when I finally make my Taylor Swift video.
Yeah, this is weird that you're like you've heard all of these things and you're a hater of all of, like, it's okay. I will be Swifty enough and Sufjan Stevens fan enough for the both of us on this podcast. I'm not like a hardcore Swifty, for the record. I mean, I did go to Eras twice. But I'm not like a stan. Like, I don't like, I'm not like uncritical of Taylor Swift. And I'm a young Swifty. I only got into her during Folklore and Evermore, which a lot of Swifties would say makes me a fake fan. But
no, Folklore's a great album. Folklore's a great album. It is easily her best album.
Well, to you. I prefer Evermore.
But no, I mean, this is why you're the favorite. This is why.
Yeah, this is not gonna help your favorability.
Oh my god, no! It's no, okay. I'll be the Ringo. It's fine. It's fine.
I will say, I have noticed there's a big crossover between 911 fans and Swifties. So it is good that at least one of us can represent that community.
That is true. I've seen a lot of edits. I've seen a lot of fan cams.
I saw a great Buddy edit set to the song Guilty as Sin the other day, which is such an Eddie song.
Is that on your Eddie playlist?
No, it's not, actually.
It's not? Because you have some
Taylor
on there.
I have one Taylor Swift song on my Eddie If He Slayed playlist, and I think it's Labyrinth.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it is Labyrinth, yep.
Yeah.
That's one of the Vault tracks, right?
That is off of Midnights. I don't think it's a Vault track.
Oh,
actually.
No, because you have a Vault track from Speak Now, Taylor's version, on your other playlist.
On my other Buddy playlist that I've only shared with you.
Yep.
Okay, for the record, audience, Ryan told me like months ago that he was thinking of making a video about Taylor Swift, and then I found out that he didn't even know what Vault tracks were. So, like, imagine the online flaying you would have gotten had you made a YouTube video pretending to have an authoritative voice on Taylor Swift without even knowing what Vault tracks were. Like, you would have been eaten alive. And so, for the record, like, we have to take your opinion with a little bit of a grain of salt, because
I want to get ahead of this. I want to get ahead of this. Like,
we don't want this to come out later.
I'm not an authority on anything Taylor. I'm just a man with opinions, which I know is something that is very underrepresented in the media. We need more men with opinions.
We need more man with opinions. The Vault track I had on my Buddy playlist was I Can See You from the Speak Now Vault track.
From the Speak, yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. I didn't mean to get this derailed here.
It's fine. We were right at the end. But speaking of, what was the song called again?
I Can See You.
But speaking of I Can See You, Bobby can now see that his purpose on this earth, his gift and his blessing, sort of what is to save all these children with his blood donations.
You could say he does not have bad blood.
Okay. No, we're not doing this. We're not doing this.
I don't know who we is.
I can't. Well, this podcast has been so much fun. Thank you guys for this journey. It's been great. No, I mean, like, that was actually really funny. That was good.
Ooh, you know, I did write in my notes during the tiger call, I wrote down, "Karma is a cat purring in my lap because it loves me," which is a Taylor Swift lyric.
How do I tie this back in?
I don't know if we can, but thank you for listening to this episode of the podcast. Karma's a bitch. You know what they say. Karma's a bitch. Karma's my boyfriend. My kink is karma. Karma's a bitch. Uh-huh. I should have known better. We appreciate all of your comments and ratings and what have you that you've been leaving on our podcast.
It is fitting that we ended on a pop girly discussion when we also began on a pop girly discussion.
Yes, and that's beautiful.
So maybe that's actually what's tying back into it. So I'm actually just going to ride the wave. Lean into it. But yes, follow us on social media. It is linked in the description. Myself,
the description.
Jane, and First Risk Podcast official accounts
on Twitter, on YouTube, on TikTok, technically.
I actually don't link our TikTok, but I guess I could start.
We have like three things posted on there. It's like, it's fine. You don't got it. But it is spelled how it sounds. First Risk Podcast. So.
And comment in our comments what your favorite pop girly karma related song is.
Is it Boy George? Please say Boy George. That would make me really happy. We got the Boy George needle drop in this episode. If not at least one person says it, I'm gonna be very sad. Although honestly, with the opinions I've shared on this episode, I feel like people would probably love it if I was a little bit sad about something. So don't say Boy George. It's fine.
You're gonna be super canceled after this one.